Good afternoon. It's my pleasure to call to order the third remote meeting of the House Commerce Committee. Mr. Brown, could you take the roll?
Chair Stevenson.
Here.
Vice Chair Katisa Watoon. Representative O'Driscoll. Representative Barr.
Here, present.
Representative Carlson.
Carlson, present.
Representative Dabney.
Dabney, present.
Representative Elkins.
Elkins, present.
Representative Haley.
Haley, present.
Representative Cagle.
Present.
Representative Lee.
Lee, present.
Representative Lilly.
Lilly, present.
Representative Lislegard.
Lislegard, present.
Representative Lucero. Representative Olson.
Present.
Representative Farr. Representative Rasmussen.
Present.
Representative Richardson.
Present.
Representative Tice.
Present.
And I'll call the missing names again. Vice Chair Cotiza Watoon.
Present.
Representative O'Driscoll. Representative Lucero. And then Representative Farr was going to be absent today, so I won't call his name again.
So I think Representative Farr is excused, and I believe we do have a quorum. Our first order of business is approval of the minutes from the January 13th meeting of this committee. Representative Katisa Watoon, have you had a chance to review those minutes?
Mr. Chair, I have not.
Okay, I will inquire if anyone is willing to make a motion to approve the minutes.
Mr. Chair, I move the minutes.
Representative Olson moves the minutes. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries and the minutes are approved. We are continuing our series of informational overview hearings over the jurisdiction of the Commerce Committee today. First, we will hear from the Department of Labor and Industry. The committee does not have budget jurisdiction over the Department of Labor and Industry, nor are we the primary policy committee for that department's work. But we do have some issues where we do have some policy oversight, and it was actually Representative O'Driscoll's suggestion that we include them. I thought was a really great one. I'm very happy to have them here today. Subsequent to that, we'll be hearing from the banking and financial services industry representatives who can tell us about the work that they do that comes under the Commerce Committee's jurisdiction. That is a primary jurisdiction area for this committee. But first, very pleased to welcome to the committee the Commissioner of Department of Labor and Industry, Rosalyn Roberts. Robertson, sorry, Commissioner. The floor is yours.
Good afternoon. Can everyone hear me? Great. I ask because I've been having a few technical difficulties today, and I hope all fingers crossed that this will go smoothly. To begin with, thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members for inviting me to present an overview of the Department of Labor and Industry. I'm pleased to be here today. My name is Rosalyn Robertson, and I am the temporary commissioner for the agency. I was invited to speak to you today to share a little bit about the agency and our intersection with the Commerce Committee. While much of the agency jurisdiction will fall under the purview of the Labor Committee, there are several areas that may be of interest to your committee. Before I begin my presentation, I'll give you a 1 minute history on myself. I am a long-term employee of Labor and Industry. I have either worked in or led each of the major, the four program areas of the agency. I worked for the agency for 30 years in varied capacities, including support staff, professional staff. I was the assistant commissioner for 8.5 years. And then I went back into the program area as a unit manager. I worked for 30 years. I retired in 2015, and I was invited back to the agency under the Walz administration as deputy commissioner. In August, Governor Walz asked me to step up as the temporary commissioner for the agency. as my work years indicate, I am very committed to workers of Minnesota and to the work of labor and industry. With that, I'll jump right into our presentation. I know we have just a little bit of time here, so I will be quick. Broadly speaking, our mission is focused on health and safety in the work and living environments. The mission of labor and industry is to ensure Minnesota work and living environments are safe, equitable, and healthy. The vision is to be a trusted resource and an impartial regulator for employers, employees, property owners, and other stakeholders. Our operating areas are listed, and the members should have a two-page flyer or handout that summarizes the work of these areas. I want the committee to have a general understanding of what we do here at Labor and Industry, and I'm willing to answer questions about other areas. But given our very limited time, I'd like to focus the discussion today on two of our operating areas. This committee and the Department of Commerce works to protect consumers, which overlap with Labor and Industry's Construction Code and Licensing Division. Commerce also has responsibility for insurance, and our Workers' Compensation Division work closely with the Department of Commerce and stakeholders such as Insurance Federation of Minnesota to ensure the workers' compensation system meets the needs of employers, insurers, and most importantly, the injured workers. As such, my presentation will focus on these two areas of labor and industry. The Construction Code and Licensing Division develops and enforces construction-related health and safety codes. The division licenses boiler operators, electricians, electrical and technical system contractors, elevator constructors, high pressure piping, pipe fitters, manufactured home installers, plumbers, plumber contractors, power limited technicians, residential building contractors, remodelers, and roofers. The division also certifies building officials. The division worked to protect the public through education, inspection, plan review, licensing, enforcement, the contractor recovery fund, which I'll describe in more details in a later slide. Since 2008, I'm dating myself, since 2008, the State Building Code has applied statewide for the construction and remodeling of buildings, regardless of whether it is required to be enforced by a municipality. In areas with local code enforcement, the municipal building official is responsible for enforcement of the State Building Code. Although local governments enforce at the local level for most buildings, DLI enforces the state building code for state-owned and licensed buildings, such as schools, hospital, nursing homes, care facilities, correctional facilities, and places of public accommodation, and those larger assembly buildings of 200 or more occupants. Minnesota law requires the state building code to conform as much as possible to model codes. However, the codes can be and are amended to address our particular geography and our climate. Further, the legislature can enact specific requirements into law to regulate construction of buildings, which is, it has done for bleacher safety, window fall protection, required safety devices for automatic garage door openers, window cleaning anchors, radon control, and smoke detector devices. The current Minnesota Building Code became effective March 31st, 2020. The chair asked me to describe DLI's role in fire safety. The Construction Code and Licensing Division regulates fire safety through the State Building Code for new and remodeled buildings, including requiring sprinkler fitters, such as in buildings used for public assembly, healthcare, education, industrial, multifamily residential, and in various other high hazard or high risk buildings as established by the International Building Code that Minnesota adopts. The Department of Public Safety regulates safety through the State Fire Code for all buildings, both existing and new, by ensuring that they are maintained safe from hazards, have adequate water supply, fire department access, and many other areas of fire safety regulated in the International Fire Code that Minnesota adopts. The committee also asked me to describe DLI's role in regulating manufactured structures. Manufactured homes, previously referred to as mobile homes because they were constructed on wheels for transport, are constructed in a manufacturing facility to HUD standard and installed on foundations constructed to the state building code. Minnesota is the administrative authority for HUD. This means that manufactured homes, dealers, and installers are licensed by the Construction Code and Licensing Division to ensure new and used home installations comply with HUD and Minnesota safety requirements and sales laws. The Construction Code and Licensing Division verifies compliance with standards by reviewing quality control and providing in-plant audits of manufacturing facilities. CCLD also administers HUD's dispute resolution program by providing timely resolution to disputes between consumers and others. In Minnesota, we have four manufacturers. In the past year, those manufacturers produced 1,646 units and 1,274 of these units were installed. Industrial modular buildings are also constructed in manufacturing plants, but are built for any purpose, such as an apartment, hotels, or office buildings, not just homes. As part of the Interstate Compact for industrial buildings, these are constructed to be to the state building code regardless where in the U.S. they are built. The compact provides uniform governance that eliminates overlapping and costly reviews and inspections by multiple jurisdictions. As a designated agency for this program, CCLD ensures compliance with the state building code through its review of quality control and in-plant audit and inspections. Prefabricated buildings are one and two family dwellings that are constructed by schools in controlled environments, vocational schools, or lumber yards, which are then later transported to the site for final installation. Several high schools and vocational trade schools use this program for training and safely exposing students to construction trades. CCLD staff provide the code compliance inspections on all of these buildings. In addition to the CCL duties I just described, one example of our consumer protection work is the current outreach effort that followed direction from the legislature in 2019 to conduct a statewide consumer awareness campaign on the importance of hiring licensed contractors. DLI engaged a marketing firm to conduct the campaign, and we're working with Home Builders Association to help share that information. An important message to consumers is you have financial protection only if you hire a licensed contractor. Licensed residential contractors are covered by the Contractor Recovery Fund. This fund reimburses consumers who suffer financial losses as a result of a licensed contractor's misconduct or incompletion of work. The Contractor Recovery Fund was created by the legislature in 1994 to compensate certain residential property owners who had suffered a direct and out-of-pocket loss due to fraudulent, deceptive, or dishonest practices. Each licensed residential building contractor pays a fee into the fund as part of paying for their license. DLI review cases, determine whether a homeowner is eligible, and decide the amount of compensation available. Currently, applicants may be paid up to $75,000 per claim. In addition to this campaign, we're also using the electrical service permit information to identify new construction in non-code areas, visit those construction sites, and check for unlicensed residential building construction activity. Next, we'll move on to the Workers' Compensation Division. The Workers' Compensation Division helps employees injured on the job to receive proper medical treatment and benefit payment in a timely manner. There are five units within the Workers' Compensation Division, and I'll briefly describe each. The Special Compensation Fund administers the workers' compensation claims of injured workers who worked for employers that did not carry workers' compensation insurance or for an employer who declared bankruptcy.
And Commissioner, I'm sorry to interrupt it, but I don't know how much more material you have, but we're starting to run a little over on time. So I just want to make you aware of that.
Okay. I will be super brief in my remaining comments.
Thank you.
Very briefly, the compliance record and training group. I'm sorry, I got lost here. It certifies rehabilitation consultants and provide analysis of medical and rehabilitation issues. I'll skip through the remaining descriptions of those units, but each of them have a very specific role. The last unit I will describe is the Office of the Ombudsman. That's a very important unit. It's separate and distinct from all other business units, and its sole job is to work with employees or small businesses that are struggling to navigate their way through the workers' compensation system. It is a great resource to refer any stakeholders to if they are having difficulty. If you are members of the committee, needs any assistance, our legislative director, Kate Perusek, would be happy to help you, connect you with that resource. Then my last comments were to speak to the Department of Commerce and how that actually interacts with our agency. So the labor and industry can make referrals to the Department of Commerce if there is sufficient evidence that's accumulated indicating an insurer has engaged in a pattern of abuse or non-payment. The compliance record and training unit can refer the matters to the enforcement division, and the Department of Commerce can conduct an investigation and determine if any administrative actions are warranted. Basically, the Department of Commerce reviews the rates that are charged by workers' comp insurance carriers and have the authority over premium disputes between employers and insurers. The Commerce has the responsibility for reviewing and granting permission for employers or groups of employees to self-insure for workers' compensation liability. Then there's the Commerce also has the authority to conduct market conduct investigation of insurers and has licensing authority over insurers and third-party administrators. And then there's the assigned risk plan. Commerce has the primary oversight of the workers' compensation assigned risk plan. The plan is the source of workers' compensation and employer liability coverage for employers who have not been able to secure coverage on the open market. Commerce has primary oversight of the Minnesota Work Comp Insurers Association, Minnesota Insurer Guarantee Association, or MIGA, and Minnesota Self-Insured Security Fund, SISF. DLI has authority over MIGA, SISF, and the assigned risk plan related to their payment of workers' compensation benefits. In the interest of time, I will conclude my comments, and if there are any questions, I'll do my best to address them.
Thank you very much, Commissioner, and I apologize for asking you to cover such complex topics in such a short period of time, and I appreciate you your flexibility with us and my rude interruption. We do have a little time for questions. I will ask committee members to keep their questions focused on the issues that the commissioner addressed. Dolly, of course, does a lot of very important work, and I'm sure members have questions about other areas, but if they could address those offline, that would be helpful in the interest of time and making sure that we get all of the testifiers before us today. Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I apologize for the wind noise in the background here. I don't have a very quiet car. So my question is just a clarification, or two questions. The first is clarification. So you went through the interim commissioner went through the various licensing for residential contractors, roofers, et cetera, et cetera. I just wanted to make sure, for my understanding, is that under the purview of this committee or is that under the purview of the labor committee? And then my second question is, in regards to the recovery fund, the contractor recovery fund, what is the current balance and how does that relate? How does the present balance and payout relate to the construction significant ramp up we've seen in the last 12 months plus? Thank you.
Representative Lucero, as to your question about licensing, I believe that that falls under the jurisdiction of the Labor Committee, but I will ask our committee staff to ensure that I'm correct and let you know that if I'm wrong. As for your question about the fund, I will direct that to Commissioner Robertson if she has an answer available.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I don't have the fund balance at my disposal, but we will get that information and get it back to the committee as quickly as possible.
Representative Lucero?
We'll look at
thank you, Mr. Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's all I have. Thank you.
And I have a note here that perhaps Ms. Beckel has an answer on the licensing question. Ms. Beckel?
Yes, apologies. Mr. Chair, Representative, I can also get back to you on that, on the fund information, but I just wanted to comment that all of the costs that would be associated with legislation for DLI would be going through the Labor and Veterans and Military Affairs Committee.
Great. Well, thank you, Ms. Beckel. Thank you again, Commissioner Robertson. Appreciate your time in joining us with today and look forward to seeing you throughout the year. We will next move on to an information overview of the banking and financial services sector, which is core to the jurisdiction of the Commerce Committee. We are going to hear from four testifiers related to this. I'll ask committee members to hold their questions until all four have had a chance to address the committee. But you can raise your hand at any time throughout the testimony, and then we'll call on people in order. Our first testifiers are from the Minnesota Bankers Association, Teresa Kuvas and Tess Rice.
Sounds great. I will start. I'll share my screen. I will leave. Look at that. Okay. Good afternoon, Chair and committee members. My name is Therese Kuvas, and I represent the Minnesota Bankers Association. I'm joined today with Tess Rice, who is MBA's general counsel. We appreciate the opportunity to join you today to give a brief overview of our association and the banking industry. So a little bit about the MBA. We represent 95% of the banks in Minnesota, from the largest to the very smallest, and everybody in between. Our focus is on improving the banking environment, educating bankers, and providing resources to our banks. And we have former examiners and lawyers on staff to help comply with laws and to provide information to the legislature and talking points and helping with any amendments and everything that you possibly may need. So in Minnesota, we still have 329 banks with a location in the state, and 277 of those Minnesota banks are headquartered here. That accounts for about 50,000 employees across the state. Minnesota is the third most banks in the United States. We are still behind Texas and Illinois. We have been number three for as long as I can remember. But Minnesota continues to have very strong community banks across the state. This slide is one that's kind of been interesting for me over the years. So I've been with the MBA now for 18 years. When I began with the association back in 2003, we had about 485 banks chartered in the state, and we are now down to 277. So it's been quite the decline, steady decline over the last 18 years. Again, we have 277 banks chartered in Minnesota, 144 of those are in the metro area. The median size of a bank in Minnesota is $139 million. While that sounds like a lot of money to a lot of us, that's not a lot of money in the regards of banking, and 17 employees in those staffs, on the staff. So during the financial crisis, some regulators had said that a bank would need about $300 million to survive the crisis. But Minnesota banks have been up to the challenge, and they remain very strong in their communities. So I just wanted to go over a couple pieces of legislation for the last couple of years before I hand it over to Tess. Last year, we passed, with the help of this committee, we passed the Senior Financial Exploitation Bill. Banks have seen over the last decade the increasing trend of scams and senior financial fraud, and they want to help their customers. And one of the tools that we've been needing to do is to freeze a transaction. So say somebody comes in and they want to transfer $50,000 to their fiance in Michigan. A bank didn't necessarily have the ability to freeze those transactions. They oftentimes would kind of hold off on their customers, do what they could with law enforcement. They'd flag it. They'd raise the concerns, but they didn't have that immunity to be able to freeze that transaction. So last year, the legislature passed this tool to give financial institutions time to investigate, to contact law enforcement, to contact family members, to help them with these cases. It also allows customers to appeal a freeze to the Department of Commerce. Banks are really good at training their employees on how to spot these financial fraud cases, and the MBA provides additional training to the banks as well. Since the law went into effect in August, numerous banks have utilized this tool and have voluntarily reached out to the Department of Commerce for that assistance. We've worked really closely with Marty Fleischecker over at the department and his staff to get some of these cases stopped. They have a great relationship, and Marty's really good working with seniors, so it's been very helpful to have that communication, that line of communication. Now that the Commerce Committee has the Budget Committee, has a budget portion as well, I thought I would take a moment just to kind of mention how financial institutions fit into the budget. Banks and credit unions are, they help fund, we're a self-funding kind of regulated industry. We pay through yearly assessments and also through examinations. So no money comes to us, to the department. We fund everything ourselves. Prior to 2017, all of our assessments and all of our exam fees would go into the general fund, and then during the budget process, the money would be reappropriated back to the department. In 2017, there was a change to set up the Financial Institution Special Revenue Fund. Inside the Financial Institution Division, which I believe the commissioner mentioned last week, covers banks, credit unions, and other non-depositories. Those non-depositories are mortgage companies and money transmitters. But what ended up happening in 2017 when that special revenue fund was created, the only money that was coming into the fund was the assessments from banks and credit unions and our exam fees, and just kind of and then a small appropriation was coming back. But all the money from the non-depositories, which included licensing fees, application fees, renewal fees, all of that money was going into the general fund. So there's about $1 million of it going into the general fund and not being kept into the special revenue fund. So we saw assessments go up that year. We saw exam fees go up that year. And all these fees paid by the regulator should be kind of in that area. So 2019, the legislature did reroute some of that money back. About $550,000 was rerouted back in, but there's still about $450,000 that remain in the general fund. And I bring that up mostly because we don't mind paying our assessments, paying our exam fees. We would like the fund to be fully functional. We want that everybody within that in the division is also paying their portion. What we have found out is that banks make up about 56% of the division, but we're paying about 70% of the of that division. And the credit unions are about 13%, but paying 16%. Those non-depositories, they make about 31% of the division, but they're only about 14% is being put into the special revenue fund. Well, $450,000 again is still going into the general fund. If that comes back, that number would probably increase a little bit. So again, we have no concerns with what we pay for assessments and our exam fees, but we just want to make sure that everybody is kind of paying what they should pay to be inside that division. And I'm going to hand it over to Tess, who will talk a little bit more about regulations and COVID.
Hello, I'm Tess Rice. I'm General Counsel for the Minnesota Bankers Association. And I'm going to talk a little bit about the bank regulatory environment. I'm going to keep viewing your screen, Teresa, so if you can move those for me, that'd be great. The banking industry is one of the most heavily regulated industries in the country. They have frequent exams, and they also report quarterly to the FDIC on their financial condition. The U.S. has a dual banking system. Banks are either national or state chartered. In Minnesota, 21% of our banks are national banks or federal savings associations, and the other 79% are state chartered banks. National banks are examined by the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, and state chartered banks are examined by both the Minnesota Department of Commerce and then either the FDIC or the Federal Reserve. This is all choice, so a bank determines who they want. They can choose to be a national bank or they can choose to be a state chartered bank. Banks with over $10 billion of assets are also examined by the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. That is not a choice. That's going to happen. And then bank holding companies are examined by the Federal Reserve. So you can see there's a lot of agencies involved. On-site examinations occur at least every 18 months, though there's been a lot of virtual exams due to COVID. There are separate exams for safety and soundness, the financial condition of the bank, and then an exam for compliance with consumer protection laws. And then we have information technology exams. And if there's a bank holding company owning the bank, that is also examined separately. This is just meant to show how many laws are involved just with consumer protection in banking. There are over 30 laws here, and most of them have implementing regulations. It's incredible, really, how much banks have to comply with. And these are all passed with the best of intention. But when we look at that graph Teresa showed earlier of the declining number of banks, this is one of the reasons. It's very difficult for a small bank to keep up with this kind of regulation. And when you pair that with the IT costs and fraud prevention and Bank Secrecy Act compliance, that's a major driver in bank consolidation. I'm going to talk a little bit about banks' COVID response. They are essential businesses, of course, because consumers need access to their money. They have stayed open during the pandemic. A lot of them have used their drive-throughs to keep their customers and their employees safe. They are in the business of working with their customers. And so the best thing that a consumer can do that's impacted by COVID is to reach out to their bank. We're hearing from our bankers of lots of ways that they're able to help, from like forbearance of loan payments, waiving fees. Banks have played a huge role in helping businesses through the Paycheck Protection Program as well. And I'll talk a little bit about that in a minute. First, I want to talk about the mortgage relief, just so you know what's happening with mortgages right now. All federal mortgages, so that would be FHA, VA, USDA, and then GSE-backed mortgages. Those are Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac mortgages. All of those have two major protections. One is that no foreclosure is allowed to even start on federally backed loans until February 28th. And then for Fannie and Freddie loans, they can't begin foreclosure until January 31st. The second important right is that they can request a forbearance for up to 180 days. All they have to say is they're impacted by COVID. They can also get an extension of that 180 days of an additional 180 days. And then finally, at the state level, the Executive Order 2079 prohibits writs of execution, which are used to remove homeowners after a foreclosure. So there are no homeowners being removed right now because the writs of execution are prohibited. Back to the PPP program, the federal government needed to get money to businesses very quickly under the CARES Act, and they essentially asked banks to become an arm of the government to get that money out there fast. Banks made over 92% of the PPP loans. In Minnesota, they made 100,000 loans totaling more than $11 billion, and that led to more than a million jobs being retained. When they apply for these loans, they have to say how many jobs are being saved, and that's where that data comes from. Those loans are being forgiven, have been forgiven, if they're used for qualifying purposes. Round three of PPP began last week. Community banks were allowed to start making loans last Friday. This allows new PPP borrowers, as well as people or businesses that already had PPP loans, to get a second draw of the PPP money. Just want to point out that all of our banks did a fantastic job getting money out to their customers. Community banks really did an amazing job. They hold about 12% of the industry assets, but they made 28% of those PPP loans, which is really incredible. So we're very proud of that. I'm going to stop there. I just want to say thank you, Teresa, and I are always available to the committee if you have any questions or concerns for us. Thank you.
And thank you for that presentation. As a reminder, members, we're going to take questions at the end of all the testimony. So next is Jim Amundson from the Independent Community Banks of Minnesota. It looks like we're just waiting for his audio to connect. There you are, Mr. Amundson.
Good afternoon. Am I up?
Yes, I'm sorry. That was probably a little disorienting. Yes, you are. You are up. It is your turn to testify.
Perfect. Thank you so much. Let me just get my screen shared for you, and I'll be underway. Can you see it? Perfect.
Sure can.
Well, Chair Stevenson and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to be with you this afternoon and to share a few thoughts related to community banking in the state of Minnesota. My colleagues from the Minnesota Bankers Association provided a lot of good information for you there. So I will be probably more brief and touch primarily on who ICBM is as an organization, how we feel community banks are different, and how the business model is unique, and some of the impacts of that, and then just share a few highlights for you. Our mission is to provide community banks specifically and only with the resources and advocacy that they need to remain independent, grow their banks, and benefit their communities. Our organization was formed in 1962, so 59 years old, coming up on 60 years next year. At that time, the issue of the day was primarily branch banking, which obviously that ship has sailed, and the industry has evolved, and that's an active, or it's a function of banking today. But we've continued to serve our members in unique ways since that time. We currently have, as you can see on the map, members from all corners of the state, from border to border, and represents about 200 community banks, or about 70% of them in the state. And I think that's roughly about 600 or 650 bank offices in the state of Minnesota. We are the, as you heard previously, Minnesota has the third largest number of charters in the nation. And we are actually also the third largest independent community bank trade association in the nation as well, behind Texas and Illinois. We're also the birthplace of the Independent Community Bankers of America back in 1930. That organization was formed near Glenwood, Minnesota, and that is the national association that we affiliate with that works solely on behalf of community banks as well. Something we think is a little bit unique about us is that our leadership is comprised of community bankers. Our board is 100% community bank focused, and I actually have a community banking background myself. I spent about 25 years in community banking prior to taking this role about 5 years ago already. And so we do advocacy. That's a big part of what we do, and we focus that work on community bank issues specifically in their operating model. Many times those views are gonna be similar to our counterparts at the larger banks, but there are times when they're not similar, and it's important that just like they have a voice, that the community banks have a voice as well. But most of our members, if you asked them, would probably say that they're a part of our organization because of the resources we provide, and those resources are driven specifically towards community banks and their unique operating model. Our member services, for example, and the education and events that we provide for them as they do their work. Briefly, you know, what is different about community banking? And, you know, if you can see my cursor, this infographic, it's really about the center of this graphic. And, you know, so it starts with some individuals who choose to bank with a community bank, who also choose to spend their money locally. The community bank invests through loans and other resources into those small businesses. And as that happens, the entire community benefits through jobs, through other products and services that are used, et cetera. And when all that's happening, the neighborhoods and communities thrive, and the individuals thrive, and the circle goes around. It's really that center piece of it. not, you know, large banks, there's certainly a role for them in our economy, and I'm not saying that by any means that there isn't. It's an important part of what we do as a nation and to keep us competitive. But when those investments and those loans and other things are happening out of market or more on a national, international level, the impact maybe isn't as direct, I guess, is the best way to put it. So the differences I've summarized for you on the slide, local focus and decision-making. I've told people before that have asked, if you don't, you know, you may not be able to identify the difference, but when you need something, you'll definitely know. When you need to go in and you need help with something, you need an exception, you need something, some support in some way, you're definitely going to know whether you're with a community bank or not. The relationship banking, these people have known each other for generations. We have close to 200 banks in the state of Minnesota that are 100 years old or older, and which is remarkable when you think about it. But these banks and these businesses and these families have literally known each other for generations. Community banks are still high innovators, high tech, high touch. You don't have to sacrifice technology or other tools that are coming today. We're constantly investing in financial technology and making sure that we're on the cutting edge of that. We're leaders in lending to small businesses and farms, both in the percentage and numbers of loans, and also kind of the satisfaction level of those lenders. There's the Federal Reserve and others have done surveys related to that, and they find that their experience with community banks, because of the things I've said earlier, is higher. Their satisfaction level is higher. The community engagement kind of follows the other points. If there's something happening in a community that's to benefit of that community, whether it's a Rotary Club or other things, you're going to find community bankers there. I've always said that we're nothing more than small businesses ourselves. We're just well capitalized and highly regulated. And so community banks can truly empathize with their small business customers. And we're omnipresent. We comprise about 99% of all banks nationwide. And so then briefly, just to touch on some recent success and kind of our lens or how we look at things. We, as my colleagues mentioned, the Paycheck Protection Program, it was a success and an important part of our nation's response to the pandemic. And community banks are widely regarded as the banks that held that program up. The program was far from perfect when it was first launched and continues to be less than perfect, but community banks responded and helped and responded because that's what they do. They kind of built the plane as they were flying it, so to speak, and they got money in the hands of these small businesses and their customers and non-customers alike. As mentioned, the work on elder financial abuse last year, we were a part of that as well. And an important part, and that's, I guess, to my point of working closely with our customers and doing what is right on their behalf. That's really fundamental and core to who community banks are. And so while we would never imply that we don't need to be regulated or that there shouldn't be regulatory burden or compliance requirements, doing the right thing is really in our core being and what we're about. And so we'll do those things, but we don't. When we look at equitable and appropriate levels of regulatory and compliance, we do believe that there's a uniqueness to the business model and that, you know, some of those requirements, many of them are on the national level, admittedly, but even on the state level, that we were aware of that burden and the unique business model and that slide that shows the contracting number of banks in the state, which is a reality. And that happens for a lot of reasons, but certainly the regulatory and compliance burden is a part of it. So again, thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today. I appreciate it. We enjoy working with all of you. I'm happy to be a resource, as I said, as a former community banker, if there are items that I can help you with, happy to take questions today as well. And with that, I'll turn it back over to you, Chair Stevenson.
Thank you very much, Mr. Amundson. Our next testifier is Mark Cummins of the Minnesota Credit Union Network.
Chair Stevenson and members, thank you for this opportunity to join you today. I'm assuming by what I can see of your reactions that you can hear me fine. And
we can.
Appreciate that. And thank you. And Simon is going to be quarterbacking my slides today, so you may hear me refer to him a few times as we go through. I'm going to be careful to try to not repeat things that you have heard from my colleagues within Minnesota Bankers and the community bankers as well. We have very, in many ways, similar businesses that we represent, but also things that certainly are very different. Simon, if you can go to the next slide as well. This is a depiction then, very briefly for you, of the credit unions in the state of Minnesota. Like you have heard before, there has been consolidation in our industry. And as we have seen, perhaps the number of credit unions that are chartered in Minnesota consolidate and decrease down to the 100 that you see here. The number of branches that they serve has continued to expand. The number of members, we're approaching now nearly 5,000 employees within credit unions and $29 billion under assets. You know, over the time that I've been here at the Minnesota Credit Union Network, which is now, you know, 14 years, and previously I served within in credit unions for about 16 years prior to that, we have seen that level, that consolidation that is very typical of a mature, highly regulated industry that you see. You know, in this, I just wanted to give you a sense of the scope of credit unions in Minnesota. You know, our mission as the Trade Association for Credit Unions is to ensure the success, growth, and vitality of our member credit unions. But it is a broad spectrum when you see here. We have over 60% of our membership is less than $100 million in assets. And, you know, $100 million in any of our checking accounts would be a significant amount. But, you know, today it hardly gets our attention in a lottery jackpot. And when you're talking about a financial institution, $100 million is small. And there are, as you've heard from others, there is a lot of challenges. But these folks that run our credit unions are very dedicated to their mission of serving members. And so we have a spectrum of very large, in fact, the largest state chartered financial institution in Minnesota is a credit union, to very small, of several of our very smallest credit unions actually just work part-time at the credit union, have very limited hours. Simon, if you can go to the next slide, please. So, you know, a question that frequently comes up for us in our industry is, what is a credit union? What is that about? And so you can see some of the very basic things about a credit union that you should know is that we are financial cooperatives. We are not for profits, and that we do not have stockholders. We have members. And so those members, through their activities, their participation, are paid dividends on their deposits, on their shares. And then again, you know, our revenue, as it would be for our banking brethren, is made by the interest that we earn on the loans that we turn around and make to those members, or if there's excess liquidity on the interest that we have from those investments. I think the key thing to keep in mind for credit unions is, you know, that the membership of the credit union elects the board of directors that represents them. And so the focus of the work of the credit union is about how do we serve the members. It's not about how do we generate quarterly profits for our stockholders, although generating capital is obviously a necessity for the safety and soundness of the institution. But it's not necessarily the driving focus for our institutions. Next slide, please. So when you look at, because of that philosophy, that member-centric philosophy that we have, we drive a lot of value back to our members that participate. And that, as you can see, the $171 million in direct financial benefits to the nearly 2 million members in the state of Minnesota. And really, if the interest rate environment was different and we had more flexibility in terms of what we could charge for loans or what we pay for deposits, that number would grow pretty rapidly in a different interest rate environment. But in today's compressed environment that we see ourselves in, these are our numbers. We're very proud of the work and that difference that it makes throughout Minnesota for our membership. Next, please. So, you know, there is an aspect of credit unions that is very unique in terms of that there are limitations as to who can be a member. Now, it is our purpose as a trade association to encourage people and be sure that it's available for everybody in Minnesota to be a member of a credit union. But which credit union they can join is really governed and limited by what we call in our vernacular their field of membership, or what's been approved by the regulators for them to serve. So these are the three core areas of how you can become a member of a credit union by where you live. And those are really, you know, going to be community-based credit unions. And with that, that field of membership has a geographic definition and limitation to it as to whether you live or don't live within that geographic area, whether you can be a member of that particular credit union or not. Certainly for many of our credit unions, it's also about where you work. There can be very specific to just one particular employer, you know, such as Toro, for example, if you're an employee of Toro, being a member of the Toro credit union. And we also have a lot of faith-based credit unions. And so you could become a member of a particular credit union if your church or your parish has a credit union and is within that field of membership. So while we feel that anyone in Minnesota can, obviously should, be a member of a credit union, we know that there are these limitations as to how each individual credit union could perhaps serve their specific area in their field of membership. Next, please. So just a little bit, you know, about our history. Our first credit union in Minnesota was founded in 1925, well before the Federal Credit Union Act was passed. And the Federal Credit Union Act then really is that area that began to see growth in credit unions throughout the country and certainly in Minnesota that provided, you know, a much better framework, if you will, for how credit unions could be chartered, how they could serve, and how they can expand. 1934 also happens to be the year that our trade association was founded as well. Next, please. Like you heard before, we work hard to have an effective dual chartering system within the state so that credit unions in Minnesota have the choice to be either federally chartered or to be chartered within the state of Minnesota. We, as the trade association, work very hard to do what we can to keep the state Credit Union Act of Chapter 52 updated as much as possible to be current and relevant and give our members as an effective choice that they can have of which chartering mechanism works best for how they choose to serve their members. And making changes on the federal level is much more difficult. We appreciate that opportunity to work with this committee to work through those and make changes and keep our charter updated. And because of that, we're seeing more credit unions convert to the community charter. And, you know, right now, just a little over two-thirds of our credit unions and the assets that they represent are chartered by the state of Minnesota. Like you heard before, those credit unions, as you are state chartered, we pay for our regulations that we have, our regulatory authorities, or bodies, I should say, that regulate us. And so we do also pay a yearly assessment, and then we pay on an hourly basis for the examiners from the state as they are in examining our credit unions. Next, please. We are insured through the National Credit Administration is our insurer of our deposits, and deposits are insured up to $250,000 on a minimal basis, very much equivalent, similar to you would see from the banking sector as well. So because of that, by law, every state chartered credit union in Minnesota is also federally insured and then also federally regulated, if you will, as you can see from our next slide. You could go to that. So we have, if you're a state chartered credit union, you are examined by the Department of Commerce. You are also examined by the National Credit Union Administration because they are checking on the insurance and safety and soundness of that. So those examinations are very much risk-focused in how they are approached and protecting the credits and protecting the members and ensuring that the institution is living up to its financial and fiduciary responsibilities to their members. We also file quarterly call reports. Those are publicly available through the National Credit Administration's website to look at those. And then sort of unique to credit unions, if you will, are the supervisory committee, which also hires CPA firms and other auditors to do the CPA audits for their institutions. They also serve as a member sounding board. If there are questions or concerns that members have about the operation of their credit union, they can approach the supervisory committee as a sounding board for their grievances to be heard and dealt with through the committee and the administration of the credit union. Next, please. So just a quick view of the growth of credit union. So much is talked about in terms of size, and that's where you see the growth rate, say, in loans and in savings. And certainly this year, through the stimulus payments, there's been an acceleration of growth on the deposit side. But what's really integral to us as credit unions is being member-focused is, are we seeing growth in membership? Are members coming to, are people coming to credit unions to participate in this cooperative financial institution? And so on the chart on the left, you can see that, in fact, that's the case. You know, the rate of growth of population within the state is hovers somewhere around 0.7, less than 1% per year. And we've had an accelerated rate of growth, and we've worked very hard as a trade association to create awareness about credit unions so that people have a greater opportunity to learn about us and to join a credit union if they feel that that meets their values and their beliefs.
Next Mr. Cummins, if you could try and wrap up your, we're running a little
bit. Absolutely. So just very quickly, because that we also have a social mission to work within our communities, as you see depicted here is just the credit unions that we have within schools, where some of the schools or credit unions have branches within schools throughout the state. Some are actually in Cook, Minnesota, as well as Owatonna was the first one to have a school chartered credit union. Next, please. We also provide this unique product to encourage people that don't save to become savers. And through that, they are entered into a prize pool that could, they could win up to the largest prize over a year's time is $5,000 that an individual could win. And unlike the lottery where you contribute to that, the credit unions create the prize pool. And as people save, they have more opportunities to be involved. And so they actually obviously keep their own money through that. Nobody loses. And at the end, you could, in fact, be rewarded with additional cash prizes. Next, please. And then we also have one day a year that we work collectively as part of our cooperative principles to work and devote time within our communities. And you can see the statistics here, the dollars that are donated and the hours that are worked through by our credit unions and what they do. And this is just a representative of one day of doing that while they do that, of course, throughout the whole year. Simon. And then as you've heard before, we've been very active within the COVID assistance and things that we have done. Many of our credit unions have stepped up to work with the SBA and become SBA lenders through the PPP program to work with their very small businesses that they have. Some of the PPP loans we have done are just barely over $1,000, but are integral to those individuals and their businesses that they represent. So, Chair, committee members, thank you again very much for that opportunity to provide you that overview of our industry.
Thank you very much, Mr. Cummins. Our last testifier today is Anna Odegaard of the Minnesota Asset Building Coalition. Thank you for joining us, Ms. Odegaard. And if you could try and keep yourself to about 10 minutes, that'd be very helpful.
That sounds great. Thank you so much, Chair. I will definitely try to keep it short. Let's see. I have done this before where I get let in right as I'm about to speak. It's a little bit disorienting. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Anna Odegaard. I'm the legislative advocate for the Minnesota Asset Building Coalition. I just really appreciate being invited to introduce this committee to the Minnesota Asset Building Coalition. I've met with many of the returning members in the past, and I'm excited to meet with and get to know some of the new members. And I just really wanted to take a few minutes to talk about what parts of MABC's work is relevant for this committee, how we've worked in this committee in the past. So I'll start with just in a nutshell what the coalition is. We're a coalition of 140 nonprofit organizations. We have member organizations in every legislative district in the state, so I'm sure we have one serving your district. About half of our members, we have 140 members, about half of them primarily serve the metro area, about half are in greater Minnesota, and about a third of our members primarily serve communities of color. Our members are direct service providers, so they're working, most of the time they're working directly in lower income communities of color, and really working with folks to build their financial stability and to build their ability to accumulate assets. And they do that through all kinds of programs. Some of them focus on housing, on supporting entrepreneurs, on workforce readiness, on matched savings. So there's a whole broad spectrum of direct services they offer. But as a coalition, we come together to do advocacy on these issues. So the coalition was formed in 2014, really to advocate for policies that provide greater opportunities for lower to middle income Minnesotans to achieve financial stability by building assets. And as you know, I know you've been listening to folks from the Bankers Association, the Credit Union Association, but the ability to accumulate savings, especially for lower income families, not only helps those families weather a financial setback, but also really provides the opportunity for them to invest in a brighter future. In the asset building world, we say it takes income to get through the month, but it takes assets to get ahead. So as a coalition, we're asking our legislators to get on board and join us in this work by passing policies that give hardworking Minnesotans greater opportunities for prosperity. And I think MABC's model is worth commenting on in the sense that I know many of you work with folks like me. You have many meetings with advocates and lobbyists throughout your day. What I try to do as often as possible is bring in our member organization from the district of the legislator I'm meeting with. And that's for a couple of different reasons. One is that we feel like it's really important for direct service providers and sometimes the low-income clients that they're serving to also have that opportunity to do advocacy, to be part of that process and to influence public policies that impact the communities that they live in and they care about. But secondly, it's an opportunity for you as legislators to hear directly from folks in your district, either who are part of these organizations that are offering and supporting asset building opportunities, so you get a sense of the asset building work going on in your district, but also so that you can meet sometimes with constituents who are really struggling to achieve that financial stability, and to hear about some of the barriers, some of the opportunities that work, some of the barriers to accessing those opportunities. So as often as possible, if I am in your office talking about a legislative initiative, I will be bringing with me, well, I guess this session, it will be on Zoom. I will be inviting to a Zoom meeting, folks from your district to talk about how our initiatives are relevant in your part of the state. So Chair Stevenson and Addie invited me to talk about some of the issues MABC has worked on or is working on that would be relevant to the Commerce Committee. So I want to spend just a few minutes talking about the work that we've been engaged with to ensure that low-income communities have access to safe and appropriate financial products and services. That's where our work, I think, primarily overlaps or intersects with the work of the Commerce Committee. I'll start with one example. About 20 of our member organizations offer free tax preparation services for low-income taxpayers. They're called VITA sites, Volunteer Income Tax Assistance. VITA is the acronym. And MABC has been instrumental in supporting those services. And then also, and this is where I think it intersects with Commerce Committee work, really helping those free tax prep sites branch out into offering more of what we call financial capability services. So for instance, we've approached the legislature several times asking to boost funding for those VITA sites and to allow that funding to be available to offer financial capability services. So financial capability services would be offering an account at a bank or a credit union at that free tax prep site so that at that, we call it the money moment. For a lot of lower income families, their tax refund is a significant portion of their annual income, especially if they are eligible for the federal earned income tax credit, the state working family credit, there are some childcare credits, K-12 credits. And we want that moment when folks are, they have their financial papers together, they're thinking about their finances, to make sure that we're using that moment to really build their financial capability by helping them open an account to make a direct deposit of that refund and to really think about savings. We, from our point of view, and I imagine you heard some of this today, you know, having an account at a bank or a credit union, a safe place to store money and access it for financial transactions like paying bills, is a basic building block of financial security. But we know that a pretty high percentage of folks using free tax prep services are unbanked, which is to say they do not have a savings or a checking account or a debit account to make financial transactions. So across Minnesota, only about 3 to 4% of people are entirely unbanked, which is low relative to other states. Minnesota is doing a good job of ensuring people have access to basic banking services. About 15% of folks are underbanked, which means they would have a savings or a checking or a debit account, but they still access the more expensive alternative financial services like check cashing services or payday loans at some time. So they it would be better for them if they were better connected with mainstream banking or credit union services. What we do know, and I know this from doing a survey of my members, is that at a number of the VITA sites that serve low-income taxpayers, again, in the metro area, we're looking at maybe 20 to 25% of their clients are unbanked. They don't have a savings or checking account to put that direct deposit into. On some of my rural Minnesota VITA sites, they estimate that about 30 to 40% of the folks they're serving are unbanked. So we really see these tax sites as an opportunity to help boost the financial capability of the clients accessing those sites. And some of the VITA sites are doing a fantastic job of even broadening beyond accounts. So the funding that MABC has asked the legislature to increase and that has been done in the recent past could support financial coaching, which is basically, you know, talking through a family budget, setting savings goals. It could be certified financial counseling, which is different. That's really for folks who are struggling to pay down debt. It could be assistance with accessing a credit report, doing education around credit building and how many different parts of your financial life are affected by your credit score. Some of these sites even offer a matched savings program or help a client open a retirement savings account. So boosting that ability of nonprofits to offer financial capability services at the point where folks are coming in to do their taxes is one of the projects we've really worked on. And I will say, I think you heard from Teresa Kuvas from the Minnesota Bankers Association a little earlier. The Bankers Association and the Minnesota Credit Union Association were both really supportive of these efforts to really help access those lower income populations that are having trouble becoming banked and making sure they have access to mainstream financial services that are safe and affordable for them. I want to talk about one other area that MABC has really worked in that was relevant for this organization, and that is around access to affordable auto insurance. About 25 of our members offer some kind of nonprofit vehicle program, so that's helping people access low interest loans to buy an automobile, sometimes doing free or sliding scale car repairs, or taking in donated vehicles and getting that vehicle out to a client. What I know from all of the time that I've had conversations with those folks is that for a lot of lower income families, even if they can be gifted or granted a vehicle, the cost of auto insurance is a deal breaker for them. And what that means is that they can't take a job that requires driving. And that's a hardship in the metro area, and it's an especial hardship in greater Minnesota where sometimes there's little or no public transportation. I knew very little about how auto insurance was priced before we looked into this. And what I've learned, and I've shared with some members of this committee, is that there are a number of different factors that go into the pricing of your auto insurance premium that work against low-income drivers, even if they have a perfect driving record. So for instance, a low credit score can really bump the cost of your auto insurance, even if you have a perfect driving record. Your education level and your occupation, your marital status, these are socioeconomic factors that are figured into our actuarial formulas to set your auto insurance premium that really mean that low-income folks are not only struggling to afford auto insurance because they have fewer resources, but because auto insurance actually costs more for them, even if they have a good driving record, than someone with more assets. So, you know, the impact of that is huge, that folks can't take jobs, or that they choose to drive without insurance, which very quickly leads to an escalation of interactions with the criminal justice system. And so we'd really like to avoid that. What the Minnesota Asset Building Coalition has been doing, we like to do all of our work in a bipartisan fashion. We like to engage with the stakeholders that will care about these issues whenever we can, which is why we're working with the banks and the credit unions around financial capability. We've been having some conversations with folks in the insurance industry who also would like to see as many people insured as possible with auto insurance. Minnesota has about a 12% uninsurance rate among drivers on the roads. So there's a lot of common ground between industry and consumer protection folks, low-income advocates like myself, to say, how can we make sure that low-income good drivers can afford their auto insurance? So we've been having those conversations. Different states are approaching this in different ways. And I really do hope to be in front of this committee later this session with a consensus proposal around how to advance auto insurance affordability for low-income folks. Because again, access to those financial products like insurance, like bank accounts, credit union accounts, Those are really the building blocks of financial stability for low-income families. And lower-income families often have trouble accessing those products or services in a way that's affordable and safe for them. So I think I'll wrap it up. I know the chair asked me to be brief. I just want to thank you again for your time today. I hope to meet many of you by Zoom or post-COVID, maybe in person, to talk about these issues, hopefully bring an MABC member from your district to also talk about how these issues are impacting your constituents, so that we can really talk about how financial capability and access to safe and affordable financial products could help the people in your district, and how you as a Commerce Committee member can be on our team and help create some of those opportunities. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Ms. Odegaard, and thank you for abbreviating your presentation. Hope to have you in front of the committee again sometime later in the year, and perhaps you can expand upon some of those remarks. We do have about 14 minutes left for questions. I'm going to lead off. I have a question related to the several testifiers talked about the declining number of community banks in Minnesota. So this question could either be for Ms. Kuvas or Mr. Amundson or Ms. Rice. This is a national issue. Is that correct? I mean, it's not just Minnesota specific. We're seeing a decline in community banks across the entire country. And I don't know, Ms. Kuvas or Mr. Amundson, which one of you wants to field my questions here, but.
Well, I'm here now, and yes, it is a national problem. All the states are experiencing it. It might look a little bit more bleak in Minnesota just because we started with so many because of our branching laws, but yeah, it's a nationwide problem.
Right.
And federal regulation.
And well, I'm glad you brought that up. I was reading a Federal Reserve report that said that if you look at the decline, the vast majority of the decline in community banks can be explained by a complete collapse in new bank entry. That they're just new banks aren't forming. Is that an accurate? Do you have any reason to disagree with the Federal Reserve's conclusion that that's what's going on?
No, I would never do that, but that's absolutely true. We haven't seen any new applications. The amount of money that you need to get approved to start a bank has been a real barrier. I think we're working on that, but it has been a barrier to new banks.
Okay. Well, I'm, you know, the other thing that I've observed that, you know, anyone, particularly people who, you know, buy a house or a car these days, knows that interest rates are at all-time historic lows and have been for, you know, at very low rates for over a decade. And the same Federal Reserve report I just referenced estimated that 80% of the decline in bank entry is due to the low interest rate environment. That is, people aren't very interested in going into banking when interest rates are so low. Again, does that make sense to you? Do you quarrel with the Federal Reserve's conclusion there?
Jim, do you want to take this one? I mean, I don't quarrel with it at all, but I know Jim was a community banker. He probably has a better insight to this.
Well, I don't quarrel with it at all. And really, there's a lot of factors why there haven't been new bank formations. Certainly, the amount of capital that you need is a part of it. And that is a function of the amount of capital you need is based on a lot of factors, the type of bank you want to be, your market, et cetera. But it also is based on the earnings that you can expect to generate and how long you may be not profitable, which is a reality for de novo banks. I actually opened a bank in 2003, a state charter, a de novo bank. We sold it to another community bank in 2015, which, as you've seen and heard, happens. But yes, it is. It's the rate environment, you know, the regulatory environment, technology, all those costs are a part of it. But the fact that margins are so thin because of the rate environment impacts the amount of capital you need, and it is in the way of forming new banks.
Thank you very much for that perspective. And I certainly appreciate that it's a very complex issue about why we're seeing a decline in the amount of community banks, and there's a lot of factors at play. I just wanted us to look beyond what I think can often be an easy explanation that there's a regulatory problem and see that there might be some other issues that are really driving that particular phenomenon. Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is a consumer protection question, and I don't know if the Bankers Association can be helpful with answering this question. And so I know that we don't have the Department of Commerce here. I'm just curious, just recently my mom has been a victim of financial fraud, and we did not know that was the case until she went to the local grocery store to buy something and her card was declined. And so knowing that, you know, the state of Minnesota is, you know, getting diverse, are you able to quantify or provide us with a scope of how big the issue of financial fraud is for our communities who may be limited English speakers for our testifiers?
I haven't seen any studies on that, but I imagine there may be. I'd be happy to look into that for the committee and report back.
Unmute there. Okay, thank you, Ms. Rice. That would be very helpful. I don't think we have anyone today, Representative Lee, from the Commerce Department, but I think that's a great, a very important issue that you raised, and I appreciate Ms. Rice getting some response, and maybe we can ask committee staff to also try and look into get you some answers to that question.
One follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Yep.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so to our industry folks who are testifying today, can you just walk us through the process real quickly of how do you communicate with our community members who are limited English speakers once you found that there may be some fraudulent transactions that's happening for their product that they may have with your bank?
Ms. Rice, is that a question that you can answer?
Well, you know, it would vary based on the bank. Banks that are in communities with a lot of non-English speakers oftentimes have employees that speak those languages and have disclosures in those languages. But I could see certainly lots of situations where you wouldn't have that information and you would probably get an email in English or a text in English alerting you to fraud.
Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so I would just make a quick comment. You know, in situations like this, I feel like, you know, we should do our job to help protect our consumers and be able to communicate with them in the language that they're able to speak in. And I would just say that, you know, for our situation, understanding some of the financial disclosure and protections that we want to have in place for victims or for our customers, you know, in the case of my mom, I wasn't able to communicate with the banker that she was working with because of the potential risk that, you know, I may be the one that's frauding my mom. And so hopefully we could work together to address that issue where, you know, we have she's an elder. She also have a language incapability. And so find a way for us to work through that so that we could help the consumers here in the state of Minnesota. So thank you, Chair Stevenson.
Thank you, Representative Lee. A very important issue. Representative Lucero, you had your hand up a moment ago or a while ago, and then you put it down. I don't know if you had a question or if you decided to refrain.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. No, I was on my phone, and I did raise my hand, was on my phone, but then I switched over to my laptop when I reached my destination, and the hand it went down automatically. So thank you. I raised my hand early on when I was on my phone. In regards to the community banks and the credit unions, as a small business owner myself, I just wanted to give a huge thank you to the community, or the state charter banks, the community banks, the credit unions. I am so appreciative, just given my background. So my wife and I both being minorities, you know, starting a business in and of itself is incredibly difficult. And so we've gone through the pains ourselves over a decade now of the larger financial institutions with the one-size-fits-all checkboxes in order to meet certain qualifications to qualify to lend, right? But that's where the state charter banks and credit unions that I've dealt with numerous have filled that gap for me and for my wife in helping us to be partners to grow our business. The point that Chair Lee had just brought up in terms of fraud. So as somebody who's in the cybersecurity field, social engineering is, and then financial transactions obviously is incredibly a huge issue right now. And whether it be elderly, whether it be people who don't have English as a second language or as a first language, they can absolutely be victims of fraud. So I also, you know, I've seen the trend as a cybersecurity professional and as a consumer of multiple financial services products. I am also very thankful for the proactive approach that your industry is doing to try to be on the front end of detecting these anomalies. You know, when I go out of state and I'm using my debit card, I'll get an email. Hey, you are deviating from your baseline.
Eric, is this you performing that transaction three states away? Or are you, you just engaged in a transaction that was multi-hundreds of dollars that deviates from your baseline? Was this you? And it was, I'm just thankful for those innovative and proactive approaches that, the industry continues to take in this ongoing effort. And to Chair Lee, you know, I feel for your, I think it was your mom you said, definitely devastating when somebody is a victim of these financial services fraud by those who just, they want to abuse and take advantage of people. And so I'm sorry to hear that, Chair Lee. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Lucero. Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the things I'd just like to have very quickly, given the time, if the folks who are testifiers today could respond on the community bank. My understanding in the part of the state that I'm from is there's like three things that are at play here. Number one, the capitalization requirement to get started with banking is rather high, which we did talk about. Number two, the experience credentials of the senior management of that bank have escalated over the years. So you can't be, you know, a state legislator one day and the president of a bank the next day, with unless you're Bob Vogel, I guess that would be allowed, or Representative Farr on our committee, because they are both credentialed bank presidents. And the other is that families aren't staying in, family members aren't staying generations in the family bank anymore. And so when a family looks to retire or to liquidate that asset for retirement purposes, there isn't anyone within the community, within the family, to acquire that asset. And then they will look to sell or merge that with another community-based bank that may be collecting assets in those situations where there isn't anyone in the family to pass it from one generation to the next. Just very quickly responding again, given the time that we have, Mr. Chair.
Yes, some reactions for both. Mr. Amundson, can you respond to that? You have about 3 minutes.
Sure, absolutely, and I'll try to be less than that. But Representative O'Driscoll, you're certainly correct in all three fronts. And you know, to the last one, well, to the second one, Representative Vogel, or former representative, was a bank president before he was a lawmaker. So that, that's probably how that works. But in terms of the expectations around, and rightfully so, the expectations around the experience that it takes to run a bank, it is a heavy lift to get a bank started from ground up, and those qualifications should be real. Succession planning is a major issue in our industry, and each family handles that differently. Some are of a mindset where they think they can get comfortable with someone without the same last name running the bank, and some do not get to that level. And you know, as I said earlier, there are small businesses like any other small business, and they make some of those same decisions in the same way. So I don't know if that's, other than to affirm your views, I don't know that I can outline a solution today other than we try to work with each of them to identify available options for them.
And Representative O'Driscoll, if you have a closing comment in the last minute, I'm happy to.
I do, and I would just, you know, because we are on Zoom, just ask for a head shake yes or no from our testifiers to this statement, if they agree or disagree. I think that's one of the reasons why you've also seen a number of federally chartered banks going for state charters, because it's easier to work with the state regulations than it is with the federal regulations to try to keep those community-based banks up and running versus closing them down or selling them or having them be acquired.
Well, and I'm seeing nodding heads just for the record there. Thank you very much, Representative Driscoll, for that question. Thank you to our testifiers today. Thank you to the committee. With that, we will adjourn today's meeting, and we'll see you tomorrow.